I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
This is an RNZ podcast.
They say life is stranger than fiction.
When you go to these super omniphobic surfaces, what you're using is you're typically using fluoropolymers, which have such a low affinity for either oil or water that you manage to repel both.
But sometimes what we see in movies or read in books is so incredible that it obviously couldn't be possible. Or could it?
What we'd say about any material that does good waterproofing, none of them are that magic that they don't wear out or wear thin at some point.
I'm Brian Crump and welcome to Sci-Fi Sci-Fact. Here to set the scene for this week's Sci-Fi Sci-Fact, an early 1950s drum roll.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are privileged to witness one of our foremost scientists at work. However, to assure the complete success of this most intricate experiment, he must have absolute quiet. I repeat, absolute quiet.
It shouldn't have done that.
Who'd be a scientist? But if at first you don't succeed, try again.
Mr. Hoskins, it's worked! I've done it! I've gone to see Mr. Burnley! I've done it! Stop him!
Sister, what's the trouble?
He's mad, that's the trouble.
This week's Sci-Fi Sci-Fact, what we're discussing is the man in the white suit, made by Ealing Studios in London in 1951, stars Alec Guinness. It's all about a piece of textile.
Do you know what a long chain molecule is? Do you know what happens if one makes one of infinite length with optimum interchain attractions? Do you know what it means? It means that to break the fiber, you'd have to split the molecule. It means for all practical purposes, it'd last forever. And it has a surface charge of static electricity. It repels dirt.
That's the plot driver. And here to talk about it, why it's interesting, and whether you could have this white suit in real life, is McDiarmid Institute Deputy Director of Commercialization and Industry Engagement. That's quite a mouthful. And Associate Professor of Physics at Auckland University, Jeff Wilmot. Jeff, welcome to Sci-Fi Sci-Fact.
Hi, Brian.
Now, Alec Guinness, I'm a bit of a fan. I think I'd heard of this movie, The Man in the White Suit, but I must admit I have not watched it. What is it about the white suit that caught your imagination there, Jeff?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting movie. It's an old British film, so it's on the 20 best British sci-fi films list, even though it was way back, as you said, in 1951. And it features this suit, which is a bright white suit. So this is, of course, a black and white film, and I think part of it is the cinematic appeal of this bright white suit. But the idea is that the hero of the story, that's baby Alec Guinness, baby Obi-Wan Kenobi, is running around trying to invent a fabric that is ultra strong, never wears out. It doesn't absorb dye, so it repels dirt. That's why it's bright white. So basically a super magic fabric that means that you can have a suit, a bright white suit, and you never need another suit.
The problem is that the local textile industry, and back in 1951, there was quite a large textile industry in Great Britain, especially in the north. That's where we sent our wool, to the Midlands and to the north of England. And they didn't like the idea of a suit that never wore out because that meant bad news for business.
Yeah, so that's really the plot device of this film, is our hero, Sid Stratton's his name. He has success and he manages to make this fabric. And he hasn't thought through the consequences of that, and neither have his employers, and neither have the unions. And of course, a kind of once, if you've make this suit that you never have to replace, that kind of destroys the demand for textiles, for clothing. So once he's made this discovery, his bosses and the local unions kind of think this through and think, oh, this is no good, we need to suppress it. And that's really the plot device for the major plot device for the film, is that they take this inventor aside and try and get him to sign over his rights to his invention so that it's suppressed and never sees the light of day.
What do you think happened to all the other things? The razor blade that never gets blunt, and the car that runs on water with a pinch of something in it. No. They'll never let your stuff on the market in a million years.
He's right, you know. Vested interests. The dead hand of monopoly.
It's not like that at all, I assure you. Everything's organized. We're telling the newspapers this morning and then going right ahead.
But if this stuff never wears out, we'll only have one lot to make.
Does he make it out of chemicals or does he make it out of wool?
He's a chemist in the film, and it was based on a stage play. It's not based on wool. So it talks about, well, it's not specified, but it talks about long molecules as being the origin of this kind of magic textile. And if we think about what that means, it usually means polymer or plastic type materials in terms of the materials that we use today.
Now, you hear the word polymer a lot when I talk to you guys in terms of a useful material for all sorts of things, often to do with some item of clothing that maybe either is really, really strong or is bulletproof or something like this. When they made the film back in 1951, were they talking about that?
It's a good question. I think a lot of a lot of discoveries were made in wartime, and like, for example, the polymers that are used in explosives, a lot was discovered around them in wartime. But the thing about polymers is they can be made of anything. So it's a really wide kind of class of materials, right? You look at nylon, that's back in the much earlier on. So there's different materials at different times. I think in terms of kind of modern synthetic chemistry, where people really look at the atoms that make up a polymer and design things based on them, that would have happened mostly since 1951, especially in an industrial sense, rather than that kind of military sense.
Did the movie invent the phrase, the word super hydrophobics, or is that word that you invented to explain what they're talking about?
It's neither, is the answer to that, Brian. Super hydrophobics have kind of come to light in research over the last kind of 20, 30 years, I guess you'd say. And really, we can just break down the name to describe what they are, super hydrophobic. So phobic means you're afraid of something, and super means something works really well. And hydro, of course, is water. So what it's describing is materials where water doesn't like to stick to the material. So it's afraid of the water, it's afraid of the material in that sense. Typically, how we see a super hydrophobic surface is that a drop of water that sits on the surface, it beads up, and it can roll along on the surface and roll off the surface quite easily, rather than spreading out and sticking to the surface.
All right, like a waxy leaf or an oilskin coat.
Exactly. And the usual example, it's actually super hydrophobicity gets called the lotus effect. And the reason it gets called that is because of the lotus leaf.
Ah.
So the leaf of the lotus plant is very super hydrophobic, and the drop will land on it and roll off. So there's two directions you could go from there. You could go, okay, so what is the effect of that? And what we're getting into here in terms of the suit is the self-cleaning effect. So this drop that lands on a leaf, say, and rolls down the leaf will take dirt with it. And so this cleans the leaf and makes sure it doesn't get covered in mud, and a lotus plant lives in a kind of swampy region. So trying to avoid getting muddy is a good idea. And the other direction you can go is to look at that leaf and say, what makes it super hydrophobic? What's the science there?
Would it be enough to be super hydrophobic? Wouldn't you need something else that you get into the bead of water as it runs along the surface of the cloth that would pick up dirt as well? Because sometimes water doesn't on its own pick up the dirt, does it? So I mean, it's soap.
Well, yeah. I guess it depends on what the dirt is, right? So typically we think about, you know, chemistry in this sense is being made up of the polar or hydrophilic type materials and the non-polar or oily or hydrophobic type materials. And those are kind of two ends of the same axis. And you're right that if you really wanted a wash clean suit that never got dirty, you kind of need both. And such surfaces do exist. So we have surfaces we'd call super omniphobic, which can repel both ends of the spectrum. There's a really good example. It's called Ultra Ever Dry. So that's a commercial product that you can spray on some fabric, and it is super omniphobic. So if you try and stick water to it, it'll roll off. If you dip it in oil, the oil won't stick to that surface either.
What's it made of?
Yeah, well, so this might get us back into our industrial intrigue, in that, you know, we don't really know, because it's a commercial product. It's not disclosed. You go and look up your safety data sheet on you know, which should say what all the chemistry is involved in. It won't tell you everything.
Really?
You know, it tells you what it needs to under you know, legal disclosure and under safety disclosure.
Well, I hope it's not something that causes cancer. Great news. We've got something that's, what was it, super omniphobic, did you say? Bad news, it's made of dioxin.
The data sheet is not going, there's protections in there for industry that they, you know, they both have to meet standards in terms of health and safety.
But
and
there's protection for us as well, I hope.
Yeah, exactly.
Good. Okay, so this is a bit of a secret, but you can, as a professor of physics, you could maybe postulate what might be in the substance or the material that allows repel both water and oil.
Yep, I can. And so if we look at then what these surfaces look like when we zoom in on them and take a good look, start with a super hydrophobic surface. It has to have two things. It has to have both roughness, so it can't be dead flat. It needs to have kind of microscale roughness on it. And it needs to be chemically hydrophobic. So you'd say if it was a smooth surface, then it would mostly repel water. And so the combination of these two things, what it does is that a droplet sitting on this surface will sit on top of the rough pillars or posts, if you like. So if you think of your rough surface on the microscale, it's got these little hills and valleys, and then you put a big drop on there, and the drop will just sit on tops of the hills and won't wet in the down into the valleys. And if it does that, that means it can roll along easily on the surface and bead up like we expect it to. So that's a super hydrophobic surface. And when you go to these super omniphobic surfaces, I think what you're using is you're typically using fluoropolymers, which have such a low affinity for either oil or water that you manage to repel both of them. So yeah, there's just particular classes of chemical that are best to use for this type of application.
However, Jeff, with a super omniphobic material, what might it feel like? I mean, it's all very well to have something that might repel water and oil. That sounds really useful. But what if it, A, is really ugly, or B, really uncomfortable to wear?
Well, that's what I was going to... I mean, you can imagine if you just wanted a white, clean surface, you could just get a piece of lino and wear that, you know? If you think of those heavy yellow raincoats that seem to be everywhere in New Zealand, or oil skin you mentioned.
Right? Yeah.
You can have heavy material which doesn't get dirty or and it rolls off.
I've got such a love-hate relationship with them. I mean, there's part of me, the smell of the oil skin, because the oil, they put the oil on. I don't know if you can explain what they did with those raincoats, but you could smell the oil on the coat. It kept the water off, but they were really heavy and sort of bulky and not very flexible. And so I kind of liked the smell, but yeah, it didn't really like the feeling, particularly around the neck. When I was a teenager, those raincoats used to set my acne off something crazy.
I can't tell you the specific oil, but the, you know, the concept is pretty simple. You just put a really thick layer of kind of wax on the top of your raincoat, and it keeps the water out. And if you, you know, deplete that wax through use or it wears out, then it doesn't work so well anymore, right? And this is what happens when you have old raincoats. But I guess you can contrast that with other types of materials, like breathable waterproofs that are kind of more common these days if you go and buy modern hiking gear.
Your Gore-Tex.
Your Gore-Tex and similar materials. And what you're looking at there is that instead of just forming this waxy layer which blocks everything out, you actually have a kind of porous structure. And so Gore-Tex actually is, it's PTFE, a type of polymer, where you've stretched it out so that you get little holes in it. And what happens there is that a drop of water sitting on that surface can't go into the holes. It sits above the holes, but air can go through the holes, right? So that means that, you know, a drop landing on you when you're wearing it will roll off, but it's still a breathable fabric and it's much lighter and cooler to wear. So that's something that's really evolved in terms of, how we do waterproofing of fabrics, what we wear.
The polymer PTFE that's in Gore-Tex, what's the main element or ingredient in that, main chemical?
Well, carbon, right? Because it's a carbon chain polymer. So that's the, what makes up the backbone of these polymers. But it's got fluorine in it, right? So it's the F in PTFE is fluorine groups. And a lot of these materials, which we say have very high surface energy between water or oil and the materials, have fluorine in them because fluorine just has that particular property about it.
Mr. Hoskins, it's worked! I've done it! Done the radioactive groups and the fiber-forming molecules haven't catalyzed the internal rearrangement, not in the least. I thought the polymerization would be sterically hindered, but it wasn't. It wasn't. Where are my notes? Where are my notes? Mr. Stratton!
Getting back to our hero of the man in the white suit, Alec Guinness, a.k.a. Sid Stratton, what about creating a polymer that does not stain, stays dry, but yet looks good when you put it on? What's the closest we have to that at the moment?
Well, I think the closest we have would be to get your suit that looks good and treat it with something like that Ultra Everdry that I was talking about before. Or get something like Gore-Tex and try and make a suit out of that that looks good. Those would be my best candidates.
Mm.
I think the other side of this, Sid's suit is that it was supposed to never wear out.
Mm.
And what we'd say about any material that does good waterproofing, none of them are that magic that they don't wear out or wear thin at some point.
What is the best wearing textile material that we have at the moment?
Oh, you might have me there, Brian. I'm not a fashion expert there. What do we wear that lasts forever?
Well, nothing these days.
Yeah, exactly. Everything wears out, doesn't it?
Well,
Jeff,
that's actually a question I was going to come to, and I don't know if you can answer this, but you're here, and I've got to ask you, and that is, look, back in 1951, here was the scenario of the bloke who makes the material that never wears out and never has to be cleaned. And we didn't talk about the fact that it wasn't just the textile mill owners and the unions or the workers who worked in the textile mills would have been annoyed about this. Think of all the dry cleaners who wouldn't have liked the idea of this suit. But he creates something that doesn't wear out in 1951. What's happened in real life is it seems to me that clothes have become more and more disposable in the subsequent 70 years.
It's a nice way to loop us back perhaps to the kind of industrial science angle of this movie, because the whole point there was around the industry not liking the idea that by introducing this new cloth they would no longer have a product to sell, right? So what you're getting at there is that it's not in the interests of companies to make materials, make products that don't wear out, because then they don't sell so many. And we've seen that the rise of consumerism over the last kind of 50 years has been a common story, that companies will make things that just last long enough to go past their warranty, and then you've got to buy a new one. And there's quite a bit of pushback, I think, more recently against that kind of idea from people who are interested in sustainable people and companies and countries that are interested in sustainability and the idea of being able to fix your own stuff and stuff that lasts for a long time. But I don't think that's been the overriding story of the time since 1951. It's been more about consumerism and buy and throw away type culture, hasn't it?
51, this is kind of before synthetics really made started to make an impact in terms of textiles and carpets and began to replace the likes of cotton and wool, right?
I think my New Zealand history might fail me here, but, you know, we were shipping wool up to the 70s in massive quantities, weren't we?
Well, early 50s was the wool boom. That's when wool prices were really high. And, you know, my grandfather was able to pay
for the Korean War.
Yeah. And my grandfather was able to pay off his farm because of the price of wool. Yeah. And these days, you can't even make money off the wool, the coarse wool that you get off a sheep's back. You probably won't even pay the full price of the shearers or the price of transporting it to the mill.
I guess in a way that story shows the kind of disruption that in the movie we're talking about that they feared, right? That, you know, by going away from the status quo, that it would leave a whole lot of people and worse off, which unfortunately in our case has been our sheep farmers until, you know, that they find different markets and different uses for wool. For me, it's kind of interesting it's quite a realistic depiction of the special kind of nature of scientific research and industry, because science is different from other stuff in industry because of the IP aspect. Like, once you'd call it non-exclusivity. So, you know, once you have an idea that has taken industry from point A to point B, you can't go back to point A and put the genie back in the bottle. And once everybody finds out about that thing, then, you know, the whole industry has changed. And people call that disruption and so on. But it's a real thing that technology and science gives you, and it has an important effect on economies. And we have to kind of try and organize ourselves around it,
Jeff,
rather than in the movie. Yep.
Which is just in the movie, they just try to run it out of town and hope that it goes away. Jeff, can
totally
I ask
unprepared,
you?
Totally unprepared, everyone panics.
Can I ask you, what is it? What do we do to. First, actually, before I ask you this question, I'm assuming that the synthetic fibers that we sometimes wear, and the synthetic fibers that go into carpets these days, a lot of carpet, the main ingredient is oil, is it? Crude oil?
Yeah, that's my understanding, is a lot of. A lot of synthetics are derived from crude oil.
Are you able to say in very rough terms what we do to the oil to turn into a fiber that we can wear or walk over?
We make polymers. So in very rough terms, out of oil, you get a whole lot of chains of carbon, and you separate them out from light to heavy. So the light ones have little short chains, and the heavy ones have big long chains. And the fuels we burn are up towards the lighter end of say crude oil. But then, the heavier ones you can process and make into particular chains that you can use in things like synthetic fibers.
In natural fibers like cotton and silk and wool, they are fibers. Now, what's the main ingredient there? I'm assuming it's a protein, but is there still a lot of carbon in that protein?
There will be. Lots of, life forms are carbon-based. I think what you're getting at is that we can kind of make these textiles out of, far more sustainably out of natural sources, which is definitely an area of kind of current research. You can do these things, but it's a matter of, being able to do it really efficiently to make industrial scale, carpets. There's plenty of people in the world who want carpets all the time. And so making it out of oil is efficient, whereas trying to make it out of, other, say, waste, lines of waste biological products will be really good in a sustainability sense. But we struggle to do it as efficiently as we might at the moment.
As Deputy Director of Commercialisation and Industry Engagement, I only just got it out there, Jeff. Are you doing any work at the moment in terms of the McDiarmid Institute and helping our colleagues in the wool industry try and produce fibres that might be a bit more competitive price-wise, and maybe also in terms of what they can offer compared to the synthetics?
Yeah, I think it's I wouldn't speak for the MacDiarmid Institute in that sense, because just we work in slightly different areas, but there's plenty of researchers both now and over the years who have, in New Zealand, who have looked at different uses for wool that are kind of, you know, more high tech, if you like, or value added than just shipping it off as a raw product. And I think that's ongoing. But I also think that a lot of the most valuable uses of wool have kind of come full circle into, you know, high quality products. So you look at things like the Allbirds shoes; those are made out of wool, aren't they? And clothing that is merino clothing, that's a good example.
Well, the fine wool, I think the fine wool market is doing okay at the moment. They are making a profit off their wool. But it's the coarse wool, the stuff off the merino sheep are doing fine, but your crossbreds, your Romneys, and the sheep that are bred for meat, but were also bred for wool. That's where it's not such a good market at the moment.
Well, I think fair to say work in progress in terms of, you know, still trying to make value-added products out of that type of wool there, Brian.
I know the man in the white suit, it's a suit that never wears out. But what about synthetics and recycling? Is it easier to recycle synthetics? Is it easy to recycle any kind of clothing, be it synthetic or a natural fibre?
I mean, I'm going to guess here because I don't have specific knowledge of kind of synthetics recycling. But my guess would be, firstly, that it would be kind of tricky to recycle the fibres in any sense because they're already processed into fabrics, right? So that's slightly different thing is reusing the fabrics as opposed to reprocessing the fibres altogether. My assumption would be that perhaps synthetics would be easier just because of that efficiency, you know, because it's easier to do the chemistry industrial at scale than it would be other materials. But I'm not too sure about that one.
I asked you, Jeff, about what is the fibre that takes the longest to wear out? Because that's really the big plot driver of The Man in the White Suit, is putting all the textile people out of work, because once you've got one suit, you're not going to need another one. Although, of course, fashion actually demands that you buy new clothes, even if you don't need them, or new cars for that matter, or all sorts of new things. That would have been one of the solutions, and they didn't think about that in the movie. But anyway, getting back to the fact that the suit never wears out, what would you have to have in a fibre for that to actually occur in real life? Is that plausible?
You want to make a diamond fiber suit, something like that, Brian? I do look at carbon fiber as, you know, structures that are known to be light and extremely strong, right? And therefore likely to be hard wearing, but, you know, inefficient to make and probably uncomfortable to make into fabrics. So it's possible, you know, it's possible to make fabrics that are stronger than others and that are, but you do have to, you know, consider aspects like, are they going to sell and are they going to be comfortable? I think if you look at silks, so especially, you know, people who try to replicate what spider silk does. So spider silk is kind of well known for being extremely strong in a tensile sense. So that's, when you pull along the thread, it's extremely strong relative to its, you know, the diameter of the thread, if you like, which is very thin. And, you know, people look at textiles that can be made out of that type of material. And so, yeah, there are some that will be stronger and more hard wearing than others, but that's, you know, what you can make in the lab is only the first step towards something that you and I want to buy from the shop.
Is there anything in your wardrobe, Jeff, that's particularly long wearing? You think, that's lasted well? And have you checked what it's made of?
There's plenty that have lasted well that aren't particularly long wearing, Brian. That's a different story.
Don't know where you're wearing that, Jeff, your partner says. Put that off. Take that off. Put it back in the wardrobe.
There's that thing where things get thrown out and then get brought back in and thrown out and brought back in. Yeah. Look, I think the for men, the old suits do pretty well, don't they? I mean, we tend to keep them in the cupboard, wear them quite strongly and put them through their paces when we do wear them, or not like in a sporting sense, but they, you know, you have nights out in your suits and they seem to survive. So I think those wool products are pretty good. That's what I'd go with.
Yeah, I'd go with wool too, but I'm a bit biased. I like Hill Country Farms.
Fair enough.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Sci-Fi Sci-Fact, hosted by me, Brian Crump, produced by Andrew Robertson, and of course, made possible thanks to the incredible knowledge of those brilliant scientists at the McDiarmid Institute. You can find more episodes of Sci-Fi Sci-Fact on the RNZ podcast page. RNZ's podcasts are also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and iHeartRadio, or pretty much wherever you find your podcasts. And make sure to follow us so you don't miss out on any new episodes.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.